The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports bettors, Circa Sports now presents Palm Saturdays with Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm. Live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Here on 104.3 The Score. And watch live on YouTube and Twitch. Featuring the latest and the greatest of the sports betting landscape from coast to coast, along with some great guests. Here he is, Mike Palm.
Good morning, everybody. A beautiful Saturday morning here in Las Vegas. 52 degrees on our way to a very mild 7 degrees today on Holy Saturday. Also 52 in Chicago at 8 a.m., but drizzling in the Windy City. We're going to talk to P.J. Carlussimo today, who took his Seton Hall team to the national championship game in 1989 before career in pro basketball. He's going to join us on the Circus Sports Illinois hotline to break down both Final Four matchups today, and he'll be on the call for Westwood One Radio as well as on Monday night for the national championship game, which can be heard right here on The Score. Well, let's talk about the big games today to start off with, or at least my thoughts on it. We're going to open with the Fighting Illini, who, as we talked about last Saturday, were able to withstand a familiar rival in the Iowa Hawkeyes. They took the Hawkeyes' best punch in the first 4 minutes of the first half and eventually wore the Hawkeyes down, dominating the boards once again in this matchup. And, for an Iowa team that, led for most of the first half and then, was tied with a little over 5 minutes to go, were not able to cover the seven. So if you laid the points with the Illini, you cashed your ticket. Later on Sunday afternoon, we saw amazing comeback by the UConn Huskies, who trailed Duke, the overall number one seed in the tournament, by 19 points in Washington, D.C., before they rallied. And, of course, an improbable comeback win with a steal and a three-pointer at the buzzer to set up this Final Four matchup between Illinois and UConn. Now, it was a long time ago, back on November 28th in Madison Square Garden, that these two teams met. UConn was ranked fifth in the country at the time, and the Illini were ranked 13th. And let's be honest, this was a game that was dominated by UConn. The Illini never led in the game, trailed by 10 at half, and lost the game by 13, 74-61. UConn was a 4.5-point favorite in that game with a total of 150.5. Transition to today, where Illinois is a 1.5-point favorite in Indianapolis with a total of 139.5. So down 11 points from the November meeting. When we look inside the box score at that game in November, UConn held the Illini to 32% shooting, just 21 from beyond the arc, and Andrei Stojakovic held to only 3 points on 1 of 7 shooting, a huge factor in that game for the Husky win. Boswell did score 25 and collected 9 boards for Illinois. Illinois, who has dominated each opponent in this tournament on the boards, as I talked about, and we played the sound from Ben McCollum last week before the matchup in Houston, and he was very, very concerned about Illinois' length and how the Hawkeyes were going to compete on the glass, and he was right to have those concerns. UConn out-rebounded the Illini in Madison Square Garden, 43-38. Both teams had 10 turnovers. So what is Illinois going to need to do to turn the tables and beat the Huskies to advance to the national championship game? Let's get Brad Underwood's thoughts on the matter.
One of the things that since we've played UConn right after Thanksgiving, I think that they're doing things a little differently than they did at that time. Terrace Reed was coming off an injury. Mullins was coming off an injury and back in that game. We're a lot different as well. But you've seen just a different shift with their group. Terrace is averaging 24-14 or whatever in the tournament. So there's a lot more post-ups. They don't ball screen maybe as much as some teams in the country, so there's a lot more off-ball screening that you've got to get acclimated to in movement. Danny does one of the best jobs in all of coaching with that part of it. And then they've got very good shooting. So, you know, they've got great balance, and they take 24 three-point attempts a game, and you got to have that balance. And then when it comes down to it, you've got to be tough enough and gritty enough to keep them off the glass.
Interesting point there. One of the Illini's strength, of course, is the rebounding, and one of Underwood's concerns is keeping them off, especially the offensive boards and limiting the live ball turnovers and stopping their transition. Not a bad job by Illinois in the first game. They only turned the ball over 10 times. When I look at this matchup, what stands out to me is the number here. Illinois was a 3 seed. UConn was a 2 seed. The last time Illinois was in the Final Four was 2005 when they lost to North Carolina in St. Louis in the championship game. Of course, we know about Dan Hurley's success, the success of the UConn program. Now only one player on that 2024 national championship team still around, Alex Karabin, but it's certainly a program and a culture that's been used to going to Final Fours and used to winning championships. I thought Illinois' path, they faced very little resistance. I mean, in terms of game control, certainly Illinois had a lot more game control in these four games leading up to the matchup in Indianapolis tonight than UConn did. You played a Fran McCaffrey team that, you know, can get up and down the floor but doesn't like to play a lot of defense, just like they didn't do at Iowa when he was there for 15 years and couldn't get to the second round of the tournament. And Illinois won that game by 35. You took on a Virginia Commonwealth team and it expended a lot of energy in rallying from 19 down to force overtime and beat North Carolina in the first round. Again, total game control. You ran into a Houston team in Houston, the 2 seed in the region, who had a bad shooting night, which Calvin Sampson's teams have been prone to do at Houston. And Illinois held them to 24 points in the first half and really had control of that game in the second half. And then probably the game with the least control against Iowa, although you could see that coming as they wore down the Hawkeyes in that game. Whereas UConn, outside of the win in the second round against UCLA, it has been tough for them. They were life and death with Furman until about the under 4 minute timeout in the first round. They blew an 18-point lead to Michigan State in the regional semifinal in the Sweet 16 game. That game was tied with 90 seconds to go. And then, of course, the big rally to beat Duke. So certainly Illinois has had the easier path. But when you look at this game and you say these two teams played relatively healthy back right after Thanksgiving and UConn dominated the game and were a 4.5-point favorite, and you look at the course of the season. Now, yes, Illinois played in the stronger conference of the Big Ten and certainly were tested more than UConn along the way, although UConn went out of conference and played Alabama, and obviously they played Illinois and played Arizona, lost Arizona in stores. I would think that this game would be UConn 2, but it's not. And we opened it a pick, and it immediately went to Illinois 2, and then it came back to 1.5 about Tuesday. And it's just been at 1.5 with no movement either way, much like the second semifinal game, which has had no movement since Monday. So it's a strange number to me. Do I feel like Illinois has perhaps played with more consistency in the tournament than UConn? Has UConn really hit their stride here? I would say right now maybe I'm leaning that Illinois is a little better team. This number scares me because I'm not sure what Illinois has done to deserve to be in a favorites role here. And right now at this point, I have no action on this game. If there's an in-game opportunity that I see, if one team is controlling the glass other than the other, that's probably what it's going to come down to. Can Illinois keep UConn off the boards? Can they limit their second chances? Now in the first meeting, out of their 74 points, UConn scored 30 from three. They shot 10 of 28 from three. So Illinois is going to have to stay with the shooters. And that's, you know, been one of the downfalls of this team this year, is that playing defense for 40 minutes has been a challenge. And I think each month I sat there and looked at my futures portfolio and said, should I add the Illini? Boy, they were playing good. They had that big run before they went and lost at Michigan State in overtime, where their metrics were number one in the country for a period of almost a month. But can they play defense for 40 minutes for five straight games? So you didn't really have to against Penn, but they've done it three straight games now. Can they do it twice more? We'll ask P.J. Carlesimo coming up at 8:25 about his breakdown of this matchup. And then the second game, which is I think what everybody was anticipating when we looked at the brackets, if we could get this as a national semifinal, Michigan against Arizona, the overall two versus the overall three. How good are these two teams? So Ken Pom, who's been keeping his college basketball ratings since 1997, so for 29 years, ranks these two teams as the third best and fourth best team of all time. Arizona, the third best team of all time. Michigan, the fourth best team of all time. So to Ken Pom's ratings, this is the greatest college basketball game of all time. Now that's from 1997 moving forward. Obviously, UCLA and Houston and the Astrodome and Carolina and Georgetown in the 82 final. You could go back before 97 and pick some greater games possibly. But I don't know what separates these two teams. Arizona had a rally from down seven at half against Purdue. Purdue played a great game. But, boy, when this team flips the switch, it flips the switch. They've trailed at half five times this year. And all five games by the under 16 timeout, they've been able to take the lead. They're a resilient team. They're great on the boards. I think the guards shoot the ball well enough. Their weaknesses, they don't defend the three that well. And we know Michigan likes to take the threes, even their big guys. And I don't think they have elite ball handling. I'm not sure why Utah State in the second round stopped pressing them. I thought that was a mistake. Michigan, talk about spurtability, the word that Clark Kellogg uses. This is a team with elite spurtability. Now, that run in the Big Ten tournament, they didn't really show it. Those 2 weeks, that week and then the week of the Big Ten tournament, we didn't see that spurtability. You know, Wisconsin held them at bay. Purdue really handled them in the Big Ten championship game. We saw the spurtability on display, though, in this tournament. We saw it against Alabama, and what a run they put on against Tennessee mid-first half to just blow that game wide open in the regional final right there at the United Center. My criticism of Michigan is I think sometimes they're too cool for school. They get a little too loosey-goosey in their half-court sets. I think they don't generally close out halves very well. They did against Tennessee, but generally they've had some leakage at the ends of halves, coming out of timeouts. Can Arizona take advantage there? Not much separating these two. I bet Arizona to win the tournament back in December, after they seemingly had beaten everybody in the top five, really, other than Michigan. And they went to UConn, and they beat Florida, and they beat Houston twice. They've had an incredible resume. I have them in my bracket winning the national championship. I'm not going to change my opinion. But here again, we open this game a pick on Sunday after Michigan beat Tennessee. And immediately we went to 1.5. And then Sunday night we got to 2 on Michigan. It remained 2 on Monday. And then later on Tuesday, we got some buyback on Arizona, and it sits again at 1.5. So both games, really coin flips with 1.5-point favorites. Let's talk a little baseball here. And this show will be live and take you right up till 10 o'clock with Inside the Clubhouse with our friend David Haw and Bruce Levine. Nice win for the White Sox in their home opener. It got delayed a day because of the rain. Maybe that was a good thing for the White Sox to sort of regroup after a tough road trip to open. And you know, Milwaukee obviously is a tough place to start. They win a game in Florida, but then they give up 10 and 9 runs to the Marlins in the last two games. They walk it off yesterday against a pretty good Blue Jays team, so that's a nice sign. I was sitting there watching all these teams that started on the road yesterday morning here in Las Vegas in the book at Circa have their home openers. And leave it to the White Sox to have a long in memoriam with both teams lined up on the foul lines. I thought that a little strange. Now, you're going to have Mason Fluharte, who has not been great for the Blue Jays, starting for them, against Grant Taylor, who had the role of opener yesterday as well. This would be his fourth appearance of the season. He's given up one run, earned run, in three total innings pitched. Expect him to try to get through the top of the Blue Jays lineup again in the top of the first. Blue Jays here, $1.55 favorite today. You can get plus 140 here back on the Sox with a total of 8.5. This game goes at 110. rain should have stopped by then, or light drizzles. Hopefully the game won't be delayed. And then Cubs today, you know, a disappointing loss, I thought, last night in Cleveland. Sixth inning, first and third, nobody out. You couldn't get a run across. And eventually lose that game to the Guardians. It's interesting because I have my eye on Imanaga. He wasn't very sharp against the Nationals on Sunday. But look, the Nats have been bashing the ball. You know, people thought, who's going to be the worst team this year, the Nationals or the Rockies? The Nationals can hit. I'm right now auto betting overs in these games. The Dodger game was over in the third inning yesterday. And they play again, the Dodgers again today. That game goes at 3:05. Total's 9.5. Glasnow and Irvin played it over again. But Imanaga for the Cubs. Ciccone for the Guardians, who was awful in Seattle on Sunday. Couldn't get out of the fifth inning. Gave up 6 earned. Cubs and Imanaga, $1.34 favorite. Total 8. I'm leaning over in this game as well. We'll give you all of our best bets in the final segment. Can we talk about the women's Final Four? Pretty amazing night in Phoenix last night. And I follow women's college basketball probably more than most. We tried to get Niall Ivey, the Notre Dame women's head coach, on the program this morning. Her and her staff did respond that she wasn't available. And obviously with the events surrounding her son this week, I get it. But she would have been good at breaking down the championship game tomorrow. I don't know how many years that last night set the women's game back. Now, am I overreacting? I don't know. And this is twofold. The quality of the games from an offensive perspective was brutal. If you look at the shooting percentages of the four teams, and these were the four number one seeds who faced very little opposition on their way to Phoenix in the Final Four. South Carolina shot 38% from the field. UConn shot 31%, South Carolina 62-48. And then in the second game, the halftime score was UCLA 20, Texas 17. Texas shot 31% from the field, 22% from three. UCLA 41% from the field, 31 from three. UCLA had 23 turnovers and won the game pretty easily, 51-44. The quality of the basketball from an aesthetic standpoint was difficult to watch. And then, of course, you had the controversy which happened at the end of the first game, South Carolina and UConn. Now, remember, UConn had won 52 straight games, really spurred on by going to South Carolina last February as a 7-point dog when they were ranked fourth and South Carolina was ranked first, and beating them by 30. No one had come within 16 points of UConn since that game. They were a 6.5-point favorite last night, and of course they lost. At the end of the game, the clock was running out. The officials blew the whistle and said there were 0.3 seconds left and made everybody go back. But to go to the handshake line at midcourt, and Gino Auriemma and Dawn Staley exchanged words, it looked like it got pretty heated. They were both pointing fingers. When you go to the post-game presser, Gino says that before the game, he stood at half court 3 minutes waiting for Dawn Staley to shake his hand. At the interview with Holly Rowe at the end of the third quarter, he pointed out the fact that Sarah Strong's jersey got ripped. Well, I don't know if there was a small tear or not, but she ripped off her own jersey. And that in the third quarter, there were 6 fouls called. This is the quarter South Carolina took control of the game. All the fouls were on UConn. There were no fouls on South Carolina. And for the game, 17 fouls on UConn, 8 on South Carolina. The Gamecocks were 18-22 from the line. UConn was 4 of 6. This bad blood between Gino Auriemma and Dawn Staley goes back a long time. I can remember, I'm trying to remember if this was post-pandemic or pre-pandemic, but it was the first time that Dawn Staley had started beating him. And I think for 2 consecutive years she had beaten him. And he went on and on about the officiating and if this is the way the NCAA is going to allow the women's game to be. It's more physical than football. It's more physical than basketball. They mug my players out there. And then afterwards, Dawn Staley said, you know, for 10 years he beat our brains in every year. We didn't say a word about the officiating. We beat him 2 straight times, and now he's crying about the officiating. Gino's got a tough time losing. He really, really, really has a tough time losing. I remember when Candace Parker dunked on UConn in a game, and they asked Pat Summitt, did she dunk twice? And she said, no, Gino could only take it once. It's an interesting comment. My other thought here is, just how bad the coverage of women's basketball is. And I guess the more interest you get, there'll be more people that want to be in that business and want to cover the game. And I know at big events like Super Bowl and Final Four, you get people with credentials that don't cover the sport all year. But the questions that are asked in these press conferences, how about asking AZ Fudd, now that you've been eliminated, who are the WNBA players you'd most like to play against? What a ludicrous question. How emotional are you right now? I mean, it's embarrassing to watch these press conferences after a women's college basketball game. Get better, people. Get better. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk to the great PJ Carlesimo. It's Palm Saturdays, 104.3 The Score.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be, with no bet fees, on 104.3 The Score.
Welcome back into Palm Saturdays, and at this time it is my pleasure to welcome via the Circa Sports Illinois hotline, betting the way it should be, Coach PJ Carlesimo. Good morning, Coach, and thanks for taking a few minutes with us.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Great, great. Really excited for these two matchups in Indianapolis, two real coin flip games. Let's start with the opener this evening between Illinois and UConn. It seems like a long, long, long time ago, back in November, when these two teams met at Madison Square Garden in a game that was pretty well dominated by UConn. They held Illinois to 32% from the field. Stojakovic only 3 points. Out-rebounded the Illini 43-38. We've seen how good Illinois has been on the boards during the four games of this tournament. For you, what's the key in this first matchup?
Well, I think throw out the first game. When you look back at stats, you have two or three of the key players, Wadler, Harris Reed, Braylon Mullins, either didn't play big minutes or had their lowest game of the year. Brad Underwood's completely changed his rotation since then. I think it's very accurate to say neither team is very similar to the way they were. You know, they also played 2 years ago in the Elite Eight. So they know each other. I think there's a little bit of familiarity, but there's so many new players, and in particular with Illinois, they're just a very different team than they were. I know Danny Hurley would be elated if they could even come close to doing as good a job on the boards today as they did back then. But I think both teams had been a little in and out toward the end of the year, and now they're playing the best they've played in a long time. Illinois is a really impressive team. They're huge. I think we talk about game two later. Those teams are very similar. These teams are not very similar. I think Illinois is a big, physical, strong team. They really dominate the glass. They shoot more threes than, slightly more than UConn does. They do an incredible job taking care of the ball. Their turnover numbers are ridiculous. To turn it over, less than 9 times a game and to average almost 84 points. Points is unheard of. So I think there's more of a contrast in this game. Having said that, UConn finds a way to win. The stat that everybody keeps talking about, Mike, is the 2 years past when UConn won the national championship, they were plus however many points at this stage, and I think they're only plus 32 or something like that from their four games. It doesn't matter. They're in their third Final Four in 4 years. They've won two national championships. They just took out the number one seed in the entire tournament. So UConn is more battle-tested. They're more accustomed to being here, and they've found a way to win. Having said that, I think Illinois is a very tough team. I love what they are on the glass, and I think that game is so much more of a contrast in style than what we're going to see in game two.
Speaking of game two, almost mirror images of each other in a dominating seasons for both Michigan and Arizona. Arizona's resume, they beat all the top teams this year, played in the toughest conference. You could argue, Big Ten is the second toughest conference, especially how well they've done in the tournament. Ken Pom's been keeping ratings since 1997. These are the third and fourth best teams of all time, according to him. I don't know what separates these two teams. What is going to be the difference tonight, Coach?
Well, you know, as similar as they are, Mike, on the glass, I think the rebounding is going to really be important because the two of them are so, so good. I mean, if you look at Michigan stats first, you know, you get the rebounding, you go, wow, they're plus 8.9 on the glass. And even higher in the tournament. That's eighth in the country in the regular season. They're plus 10 in their four games in the NCAA. And then you go over to Arizona, and they're plus 11 on the glass. I mean, it's ridiculous how dominant these two teams are. I happen to have had Arizona both weeks. I was in San Diego with Kevin Kugler the first week. And had Arizona there, and then I had them the second week in San Jose with Ryan Radke. So I've seen them four times already. I live out in Seattle, so I see Arizona more than I see Michigan. I think you make a great point. What the two of them did in the regular season, Arizona, it's hard to say dominate, but they did. They won the regular season, and they won the postseason tournament in the Big 12, which is an incredible double to do. Michigan did win the regular season, but they weren't able to win the tournament. Purdue took care of that. But as you mentioned, they do so many things well. I think neither one gets credit for how good a defensive team they are. When you look at their, you know, you see their offensive field goal percentage numbers, you go, wow. And then you take a look at the defense and you go, are you kidding me? Michigan is number two. Connecticut is number eight field goal percentage defense. So they're really balanced teams for certain. Michigan takes more threes than Arizona. Arizona takes very few threes. That's going to be a factor in the game, I think, how well Arizona defends the three-point line and whether or not Michigan's able to make as many threes as they normally make. The other stat that jumps out at you when you look at Arizona, they do about the best job in the country getting to the free throw line. They're incredible. Usually the advantage they have in free throws and putting the other team in the bonus. And yet when you look at Michigan's a team that does a great job not fouling. They're top 40 in the country, you know, out of 360 teams. They don't foul very much. So, I mean, it's really that game. Game two is really interesting because you got strength going against strength. You have some areas where one team is a little better than the other, whether that's going to hold out or whether, you know, we're just going to have a war. I think that's going to be a one-possession game, and I do think that the rebounding is going to be a very telling stat. If one team is able to get an edge, particularly on second chance, you know, second chance points or offensive rebounds, it still amazes me that Arizona can bring off the bench, you know, Tobey Awaka, who's one of the better rebounders in the country, one of the best offensive rebounders in the country, and Anthony Deloso, who were starters for them last year, and they're bringing him off the bench. And then you got freshmen in this game in Burries and Pete and Wagler in particular, you know, just saying those three that have had as good a year as any freshman in the whole country. So I'm really looking forward to these teams, the way they're playing right now. And again, you got a coach who was just in the Final Four a couple of years ago in Dusty May with his Florida Atlantic team. And Tommy Lloyd has just done such an incredible job in 5 years at Arizona, but this is his third Final Four. He was there twice with Gonzaga, and it seems like he was just here a couple of years ago. We did the championship game in an empty Lucas Oil. Fortunately, it's not going to be an empty Lucas Oil this time.
We're talking with Coach P.J. Carlesimo, calling both games today and the championship game on Monday night for Westwood One. That championship game will air right here on The Score. P.J. will be alongside Kevin Kugler, Robbie Hummel, and Andy Katz. Coverage will begin immediately following Cubs baseball with tip-off at 7:50 and clear FM quality on 104.3 The Score. Coach, I have a question from a listener. Coach, great. Your career arc is fascinating because it flips the traditional power structure on its head. You spent nearly a quarter century as the voice, the head coach, the decision maker, the one setting the tone, and program director. Then after stepping away for a couple of years, you came back into the league not as the voice, but as part of the chorus as an assistant. That's not just a professional adjustment, it's an identity shift. Going from being the program to being a servant to someone else's vision. So take us inside that tradition. transition. How difficult was it really to recalibrate your mindset? Were you able to fully commit to being an assistant, pouring everything into helping another coach execute his plan? Or after leading for so long, did you still have that internal voice evaluating, questioning, maybe even seeing how you would have done things differently?
No, it's a great question, Mike, but actually it was very easy. When I was a head coach for 23 years in college and good chunk of 17, 18 years in the NBA, I tried to hire people who had been a head coach as an assistant because you have a different perspective. You kind of think through suggestions. Sometimes, particularly when you're a young assistant, you'll say, like, you'll just kind of blurt something out. You'll say, do this. Not that young assistants aren't good, don't get me wrong, but they don't sometimes think of all the implications that go with whether it's a substitution or a lineup change or a change in the way the game is going. I think if you've sat in that first chair, if you will, you have a tendency to see the bigger picture. So I really think that having been a head coach is a tremendous asset for somebody to be an assistant. And the first person that I worked for in the NBA is one of the best to ever coach the game of basketball, certainly on the professional level, Greg Popovich. And Pop, when we talked, we sat down and we talked about, at the time I had gotten let go at Golden State. My first pro job was Portland for 3 years, and I was Golden State for three. And Pop said to me, like, are you going to continue broadcasting or do you want to coach? I said, no, I want to coach. And he said, okay. And I said, you know, what would you be looking for? What can I do to help you? And he said, I need you to sit next to me as if you're the head coach and tell me what you see. And he said, I've got really talented assistants. And he certainly did. Mike Budenholzer was there. Mike Brown was there. Brett Brown was there. I mean, it was an incredible staff. And he said, I don't need another young coach. He said, I need somebody who sat here, and I need you to not necessarily agree with me. You know, you and I coached against each other. I want somebody who's not afraid to tell me, no, this is crazy. We shouldn't be doing this. What about this? So Pop made it very, very easy for me because I think he had pretty much the same philosophy as I did in terms of what you want from an assistant coach. You don't need somebody to yes you to death and agree with everything you say. You need somebody that's not afraid to challenge you. You may not agree with them, but you want to hear, you know, you want to hear a different opinion. And then once you make the decision, this is what we're going to do, then that's it. That's the direction you go. But you want somebody who's not afraid to disagree and can maybe come up with a suggestion that's different than what you're thinking. So it was a lot of fun working with Pop. He'd be the first to tell you when you have Tim Duncan and David Robinson and Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker, a lot of suggestions end up very, very good because we had among the best players in the league playing for the Spurs.
Coach, we'll take you out of here with this. Much of the national conversation last night and this morning is about losing with dignity and class. Obviously, last night we saw some issues at the end of the UConn-South Carolina women's game. In the small world category, I went to the Crown basketball games on Wednesday and Thursday, and Tim Claugherty was doing the games. Of course, the son of John Claugherty. It's 1989, and of course, John, one of the best officials in the game, in my opinion, with Timmy Higgins and Jim Stupin, had a great career. Obviously, he anticipated the foul against Gerald Green on Ramil Robinson with 3 seconds to go in the national championship game when there really wasn't any contact. Coach, the way you handled that should be an inspiration to people who are coaching at every level. The way you lost with class and dignity and didn't blame John Claugherty. Take us inside those moments when that happened.
Well, first of all, Mike, I'm surprised you can remember that. I know I'm getting senile that you can remember back that well to 89. That's great. John Claugherty was one of the best officials. Like I said after the game, you know, when people ask about the call, people said, you know, how could you – biggest game you've ever been involved in your life. Your team was that close to winning. We end up losing by one in overtime to Michigan. I don't like the fight song. I told Dusty May that yesterday. I don't want to hear Hail to the Victors. When they came on the court for practice – 2 days ago, and we're sitting there watching. I'm sitting with Bill Raftery, and I'm saying, man, I don't want to listen to that fight song anymore. But I understood. Truly, if I could have picked the officials for that game, it was Tom Rucker, Mickey Crowley, and John Clockety. John would have been one of the three officials. Like, if someone said, you're never going to get a bad official, don't get me wrong, in a championship game in the NCAA, but John Clockety would have been one of the guys that I picked. And the game was well officiated. I obviously did not like that call at the end. But, what are you going to do at that point? Our kids did a great job. I think that for a team that lost in the championship game, our kids handled that situation better than anybody and were really praised for it and had a lot of great compliments about our Seton Hall team. Gino Auriemma is one of my close. He's a good, good friend. Where they're at with that, was it 54 game streak or whatever it was? I was actually in a restaurant, to be honest with you. We were watching the game. We made sure that we had a TV there so we could see the game. We were at IRIS here in Indianapolis, but I didn't watch the game closely. And the difference, I think, and it's not fair for me to say that because I didn't watch the entire game. Our game was really well officiated, the Michigan game. So I didn't have any complaints about the officiating until the very end of the game. Gino obviously had some complaints about the officiating during the game, but it wasn't typical Gino. Let me just let it go at that, because the love and the respect that I have for him. But that was Dawn Staley is also a good, good buddy. I've known Dawn since back when she was a great player, so I've known her a long, long time. Not as long as I've known Gino, but for a long time. But you really don't want to see that ever. You especially don't want to see that in the national championship semifinal.
Coach, we appreciate your time this morning. Have a great three broadcasts in Indianapolis, and everyone here on 104.3 The Score will be listening on Monday night. All right, when we come back, my best bets for the day. It's Palm Saturdays, 104.3 The Score.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, real people tell their stories live on stage.
I burst into tears, and I wasn't sure if I was crying because I hadn't been kissed in a really long time, or if I had just never been kissed like that before.
To hear fascinating, heartbreaking, and sometimes hilarious stories from astronauts, teachers, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be, with no bet fees, on 104.3 The Score.
It's Palm Saturdays right here from Bar Canada at the D, and next weekend, Masters weekend, Rahimi Harris and Grote will be broadcasting from Stadium Swim at Circa. They'll be here both Friday and Saturday, 10 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. on Friday, and then their show 11 to 12:45 p.m. on Saturday. There'll be food and beverage specials for the golf tournament, and every angle, every shot, all the different coverages that are available for the Masters will be up on that big screen at Stadium Swim. Come hang out with some of the stars of The Score. That's next Friday and Saturday at Stadium Swim. We're taking you right up to inside the clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haugh. 10:30 today, Ozzie Guillen will join the guys. All right, let's go through best bets for today. You know, listening to Coach Carlissimo, I'm going to get some action in on this Illinois game. This total, what an adjustment from 150 to 139. PJ's right. Illinois is so efficient with the ball offensively. And as good as they are rebounding, I do think UConn's going to get some second chance points. And I do think that the Huskies are going to be able to they got 30 the first game from three. I'm not saying 30, but I think they'll be in the 20s at least with their three-point shooting. Let's go over the 139.5. I think that's too big of an adjustment from the 150. In the first game. All right, we talked a little baseball. Mentioned this already. Let's just continue to bet Nationals games over. They have very little pitching, and they can hit the ball. This is not one of the worst few teams in baseball. I guarantee you that. The total today, 9.5. This game goes at 3:05 Central from our nation's capital. Glasnow against Irvin. Over, Dodgers. Nats. Another game I like, one of my guilty pleasures in betting is I like to bet Seth Lugo to win Cy Young every year because I think he's undervalued to the market because of how badly the Mets mismanaged the first 7 years of this guy's career. Well, he's a starter. Well, he's an eighth inning guy. Well, he's a long reliever. Oh, he's a starter. No, he's our closer. No, he's a middle reliever. No, he's a, what now? How could anybody adjust to that? He gave us a run last year until he, you know, his arm went dead in August. But at 75-1, we were in the top six in the Cy Young odds markets in June and July. I didn't bet him this year, and I'll tell you why. It's because what the changes that they made at Kauffman Stadium, they brought the fences in between 9 and 10 feet. And they took the height of the fences from 10 feet to 8.5 feet. Seth Lugo is a flyball pitcher, folks. Now, I know Jensen Lewis will tell you his swing and miss rate, it shouldn't be that big of a factor. But when you get less than 40% of your outs from ground balls, and it's understandable, he throws a four-seam fastball and he throws a high rotation curve. That's a lot of fly balls. How is it going to affect him? His first start of the year was in Atlanta Sunday. He was awesome. He went 6 2/3, gave up 5 hits, no earned runs. He's starting. They have a doubleheader with the Brewers today because of the rainout yesterday. He's starting the second game, which goes scheduled to go at 6:10 Central Time against Sprout, who was awful in a win against the White Sox. He gave up 7 earned in 3 innings. How about Lugo at a pick'em today at home? A lot of respect for the Brewers in the market, and I get it because Pat Murphy plays the game the right way. Believe me, he does. They're averaging 2.7 stolen bases a game again. Nobody, you watch baseball and the two things that stand out, nobody knows how to run the bases. There's no bullpens, right? That's the two things that glaringly stand out as you watch baseball early in the year. Pat Murphy's teams know how to run the bases, and they put pressure on you for 9 innings. All right, let's go to the ice here as we're wrapping up the final days in the NHL season, and what a wild Eastern Conference this is. They're going to set a record this year for the team with the most points that doesn't make the playoffs. 97 was the previous record. The projection was 99 last week. It looks like 98 now. Could be 99 again. The teams that need to win have struggled a little bit in the East. And out of nowhere, here come the Flyers, by the way, who won again last night at the Islanders. This Flyers team, they were 200-1 2 days ago to win the Cup. I mean, we've had to lower them to 70-1 because it looks like, to me, with the momentum they have, they're going to get in the playoffs. But let's take a look at our NHL card today. There's a few spots here that I do like. Teams needing to win or just teams in better spots. Now, at this first game, people will say, well, both these teams need to win because Winnipeg's not out of it. If you watched Winnipeg play at Dallas this week, you would say this team doesn't even look like they're interested in being in the playoffs. And I know that's a facetious statement. Columbus has struggled. It looked like Ricky Bonus, he took over as the head coach. They were going to cruise their way into the playoffs. They've lost 4 of 5. They got beaten a home-and-home with Carolina, which, I mean, Carolina's going to be top 3 points team in the Eastern Conference. But now the Jets come to Columbus. I think this is a cheap home favorite here. Let's lay $1.40 with the Blue Jackets here. This game goes at 6:07 Central Time. I looked hard at the Red Wings. They're at the Rangers. The Red Wings need to win. The Rangers are out of it, but this price is a little much. I could be convinced to lay the puck and a half with the Red Wings plus $1.62, but at this point, I haven't put my toe in the water just yet. How about the Knights? What a strange move, firing Bruce Cassidy with 8 games left in the season. Yeah, I get it. He's brutal to work for. He's not a nice man. Da, 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 da. Well, haven't we known that for his career? I mean, Krejci left Boston, went back to Croatia because he couldn't stand the guy, and then he came back once they fired him in Boston. They won a cup with the guy. Maybe they needed to save the mentality of the team. I don't think the move going to Tortorella, who's also an old-school, hard-nosed guy, although much more compassionate from what I hear from people that have played for him, than Cassidy. It's not going to save the Knights. The Knights didn't get a goalie. The Knights still have not been able to play defense since Alec Martinez retired, and they lost Pietrangelo, and they lost, you know, these guys that were tough guys, Hague, White Cloud, they're gone. These guys would hit you just for looking at their goalie. They don't have that anymore. And I think it's a terrible spot for them. Edmonton has changed their game. Draisaitl went out, and they've taken a much more defensive posture, and they played well defensively. Even Jari's won a couple games. Ingram's been solid in net. I know the Knights played a great game against Edmonton. It's been the best game they've played when Edmonton was here at T-Mobile. But now they go to Edmonton. This game goes at 9:07 Central, and Edmonton's only a $1.15 favorite. Give me the Oilers tonight, okay? Give me the Oilers. Also, play against the Knights in the first period. The change of coaches didn't change the fact they always get behind in every game. Do you know who is the team that's trailed the most minutes in the NHL this year? It's not god-awful, all-time worst Vancouver. It's the Vegas Golden Knights. Take a look at that as well. I'm going to take Seattle. Seattle's in a pitch battle here. The Blackhawks, they're playing out the string. Sorry, Chicago. It is what it is. I don't want to lay $1.75, but the Kraken minus a goal and a half tonight, plus $1.50, sign me up, Kraken. And then Nashville at San Jose. You know, I'm an under player here, but San Jose, obviously, these kids go from the jump. Now, you know, our friend Jonathan Davis that was a guest on the show about a month ago has this Macklin Celebrini Hart Trophy ticket that he's been pimping and pimping and pimping. And when the odds went to 40-1 last week when it looked like the Sharks wouldn't make the playoffs, I said, you're wrong. Well, they're back down to 10-1 because the Sharks have won three in a row and they're right back into the race. My play here, though, is the over in this game. Nashville at San Jose goes at 9:07 Central. We're going to play over 6.5. That's at even money. Thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks to Coach PJ Carlissimo. He was great. Listen to him Monday night here on The Score in the national championship game. That follows the Cubs. We wish everybody a very safe, a very blessed Easter. And stay tuned. Up next, Inside the Clubhouse with David Haw and Bruce Levine. We'll see you next Saturday on Palm Saturdays here on The Score.
Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.